Good morning or good afternoon, depending on where you are, and welcome to the Jewish Policy Center conference call with Richard Baer. I'm Shoshana Bryan, Senior Director of the JPC and host of this call. Housekeeping first, if you have questions, your phones are muted, you can't ask. Please send them to us by email at info@jewishpolicycenter.org. That's info@jewishpolicycenter.org, or tweet them to our Twitter account at the JPC. That's at the JPC. Both are being monitored during the presentation. Now I would like to introduce our guest, Richard Baer. Richard is a member of the JPC Board of Fellows, which really is all you need to know about him. But actually, he is also the chief political correspondent for American Thinker, and he writes regularly for Israel Hayom and PJ Media. He is a management consultant for the healthcare industry in his other life, and president of Richard A. Baer & Associates. He frequently serves as an expert witness in healthcare litigation cases involving planning and financial matters. I promise we'll have him back when we do Medicare for All. His subject today, though, is demography. Is it destiny for both political parties? As you know, we don't do politics here at the JPC. This discussion will focus on immigration trends and the movement of people among the states, birth rates, and how distinct American subgroups see the future. As a reminder, send your questions to info@jewishpolicycenter.org or to our Twitter account at the JPC. Richard, I'm happy to turn the floor over to you.
Thank you very much. And thanks to Shoshana for the invitation, and thanks to anyone who's setting aside part of their day to listen. The question about whether American politics, demography is destiny, is raised because in 2002, two fairly well-known political scientists, John Judis and Reed Teixeira, wrote a book called The Emerging Democratic Majority. Their argument was that white college-educated individuals and minority voters were increasing as a share of the total electorate, and those groups over time would become more Democratic-oriented, while the group that favored Republicans, which are whites without a college degree, was dropping as a share of the population. So if the groups in which you do well are growing and the groups which you do poorly are declining in size, then obviously that suggests you may have a majority baked in. Has the thesis worked out as predicted? Turns out it has not had any kind of straight line path, and there have been a lot of bumps along the way. Depending on the year you look, you could make an argument that it's exactly what the authors predicted. And you look at other years and you say that they couldn't have been further off. Judis himself, who is one of the two authors, claimed he was mistaken in an article in 2015 where he wrote a new article on the emerging Republican majority, and also talked about in an article in 2017 how he'd been mistaken. But after the 2018 midterms, it's not so clear that he wouldn't go back to his original thesis and make an argument that what he had argued in 2002 was in fact coming to pass. So the question is, what is going on? Are there certain long-term trends which you can't really fight if you're in one party or another? How much of a role do specific issues and specific candidates play in specific electoral cycles? Are there still swing voters left? Has America become such a partisan country that basically everyone is in one camp or another depending on their group? I think not. But the number of people who actually do swing from election to election seems to be declining. So let's look at some of these demographic factors to begin with. In 1988, in the presidential election, George Herbert Walker Bush ran against Michael Dukakis. In that election, white vote was 85% of all votes, and the minority vote, blacks, Hispanics, Asians, American Indians, were 15%. The white vote was won by Bush by about 20%. And the minority vote was won by Dukakis by 80% to 20%, or a 60% margin. If you carry through the math, given that the white vote is much larger, even with a smaller margin of only 20%, you come up with an 8% victory for Bush over Dukakis, which is, in fact, exactly what occurred. What's happened since then? Well, let's look at 2012. In 2012, when Romney was running against Obama, amazingly enough, the vote shares by groups were almost identical to 2008. The white vote went by about 20% for Romney. The minority vote went by about 60% for Obama. But instead of the Republican winning by 8%, the Democrat won by 4%. And the reason is that the white share of the vote had declined from 85% in 1988 to just a drop over 70% in 2012. And suggest that on an annual basis, the white share of the vote has been declining about 0.5% per year. Now, it's not going to go to zero, but it is clearly declining. And just as the white population is declining and births among whites are declining, so it shouldn't be a great surprise. There are enormous demographic shifts underway as a result of immigration and differences in the birth rates. But what's going on is not linear. In 2004, George W. Bush won the popular vote by 3 million. 4 years later, Barack Obama won the popular vote by 9.5 million. That's not a shift due strictly to demography. It has to do with the candidates, the special nature of the 2008 election with the first black candidate for president. In fact, the 12.5 million vote share shift from 2004 to 2008, almost half, 6 million of the 12.5 million, was just a change in the margin among black voters. Now, one would throw up their hands and say, how is that possible? Blacks always vote 90% Democratic. Well, they voted 88% for Dukakis and 96% for Obama. And instead of there being 12.5 million black voters, there were 16.5 million black voters. Instead of being 10% of the electorate, they were 13% of the electorate. So you can see that small changes like that can have a dramatic effect on who wins or who loses or by how much they win in a particular year. In 2016, if you watch the election returns at night, and they went on for quite a long while during the night, regardless of which channel you watched, you could tell subtly or not so subtly that everyone expected Hillary Clinton to win. Now, the reason for that was the newscasters are all privy to the exit polls, which are conducted during the day among about 20 to 25,000 voters, and they showed a Hillary Clinton victory by 4% in the popular vote. Well, you win the popular vote by 4%, no one is going to lose the Electoral College. But turns out she didn't win the popular vote by 4%, she won the popular vote by 2%, and she did lose the Electoral College because she lost three states in the upper Midwest, all by less than 1%, and she lost Florida by just over 1%. So that difference between a 4% margin and a 2% margin seems to have shifted a bunch of states from one party to the other. Why did the exit pollsters get things wrong? Well, they can get things wrong because they don't have a representative sample. People don't honestly tell them what goes on. Or 2% and 4% is not that big a shift. It's something that in most polls is within the margin of error. And as a result, it shouldn't be a great surprise if you're wrong by a couple percent. Everyone assumes that the number that comes out is the number, when in fact there's a range. If you have a 2% give or take on a poll with an estimated 4% margin for someone, that means they could win by 2 or they could win by 6. So turnout percentage can change, as we saw with African Americans in the 2008 election, but so can preferences, as occurred with African Americans, and in particular occurred among white voters in 2018. Why did the Republicans have such a bad year in the 2018 House elections? Well, the reason is that instead of white voters giving them a 20% margin, they gave them only a 10% margin. The minority vote was about the same share of the electorate as it had been in previous elections and gave about the same 60% margin to the Democrats, an 80 to 20 to split. But the change in the white voters, that 10% shift, caused a fairly dramatic change in the outcome of the election. Instead of Democrats winning the popular vote by 2% as they did in 2016, they won by about 9% if you add up the votes of all the 435 congressional districts. That 7% shift occurred because of the change in the white vote, which affects about 70% of the population. So you have a 10% margin shift times 70% of the population. There's your 7%. Now, there are obviously issues beyond white voters and black voters. There are white voters with college degrees and white voters without college degrees. Among Hispanics, they don't all vote the same. There are differences in voting patterns between Cubans in Florida and Puerto Ricans in New York. their differences in voting preferences between Mexicans in Texas and Mexicans in California. Texas is more of a minority state than California at this point, and yet Texas has been solidly Republican, certainly less so today than it was a couple of years ago. But compared to California, which gives Democrats margins of 25-30%, enormous differences. And one of them is that Hispanics don't vote as overwhelmingly Democratic in Texas as they do in California. At this point, America, to give you some idea of how diverse this country is, the white population of America at this point is about 62% of the country. Hispanics are about 18.5%, African-Americans, blacks, 12.5%, Asians, virtually at 6%, 5.9%, Native Americans, about 1%. We are close to 330 million people. Most people project we're going to reach a peak of perhaps 440 million by the year 2050. And the projections out to 2050 is that the white share of the vote will decline from 62, the white share of the country will decline from 62% to 47%, 15% decline in 30 years, 0.5% per year, similar to the trend we've seen since 1988. Hispanics would grow to 29%, African Americans would stay in the 12.5-13 range, but Asians would grow to 10%. One of the questions you sometimes ask yourself is why in the last couple of years has there been this enormous growth in race consciousness between Black Lives Matter, demands for reparations, the New York Times was creating a series on America's real founding was with the introduction of slavery in 1619. And one partial explanation I'd offer is that African Americans have historically been the American minority. It's their story that is the most significant minority story in America because they came here as slaves. And now their numbers are being overwhelmed by the growth in Hispanic numbers. So the African American community is now 20 million smaller than the Hispanic community, and that number is growing every single year. So in essence, the campaign essentially to raise race consciousness may in part be because of an expectation of a diminished role and diminished demands for their share of whatever the American pie is in the future, because they are not going to be the significant minority group anymore. At this point, Hispanics are well over one quarter of all births in America. They have the number of live births among Hispanics is more than double the number among African Americans at this point. Let's look at changing birth rates. The American birth rate reached its lowest level in 32 years. Actually, the lowest level ever, the lowest actual number of births in 32 years in 2018. The birth rate was 60.3 per 1,000 women of childbearing age. Now, what does that mean, women of childbearing age? It's women aged 15 to 44. So if you take the number of 60, roughly, multiply it by 30, you get 1,800, divide because you're doing it per woman, you get 1.8, essentially, is the American birth rate at this point. 2.1 is replacement. At this point, we're almost 15% below replacement level. In 1954, the birth rate was 118 per 1,000 women per year, age 15 to 44, which produces an average family size of slightly over 3.5 children per family. That number dropped precipitously over the next 20 years. It hit 65 in 1975, so really has not declined that much over the last 40 years. The sharp decline was from the 50s to the early 1970s. What's interesting, too, is that in the United States, birth rates are dropping for every group that gets here. The Hispanic birth rate was as high as 95 per 1,000, is now at 68. Only one group among Hispanics, in fact, has a well above average birth rate at this point, that's Central Americans. The black birth rate, 63, whites, 57, Asians, 59, Native Americans, 41. So essentially, every group at this point is below replacement, including Hispanics, which is a completely different picture than was the case 10 or 20 years ago. In the last year, there were fewer than 3.8 million births and over 2.8 million deaths. That's the smallest increase in the natural population, the difference between births and deaths, that's occurred in the United States in 50 years. So it's fewer than a million at this point, and those numbers, those lines, at some point will cross because the death number is growing. What about immigration? Obviously, immigration is a primary reason why the country has become more diverse, and the shares of the total population are changing because of who the United States allows in, both legally and who come in illegally. At the moment, there are 43 million foreign-born people in the United States who are legal residents or existing citizens already, and that represents a little over 13% of the population, near the all-time high from 1910 of just about 15% of the population. Now, that's lower than Canada or Australia, but higher than a lot of other countries in the world. Legal immigration has been slightly over 1 million per year on average for the last 7 or 8 years. Some years it's been as high as 1.2 million, other years more like about 1 million. But where do these immigrants come from? And again, this is the legal immigration. About 14% come from Europe, Canada, and Australia. These are among those who are foreign-born in the United States now. 27% have come from Southeast Asia or other parts of Asia, 25% from Latin America, other than Mexico, 26% from Mexico, 8% from Africa. That would suggest that basically about half of current foreign-born population are from Latin America, they're Hispanic, about a quarter are Asian, and then the rest divided among the rest of the continents. But if you look at the latest year, the numbers are quite different. In fact, Asian immigration to the United States is now virtually the same as immigration from Latin America. 42% of the last year was from Latin America, 40% from Asia, 10% from Africa, 9% from Europe, Canada, and Australia. Europe, Canada, and Australia are, by and large, mostly white immigrants, though not exclusively. So if you have a country where 90% of the new immigrants to the country that are legal are in fact non-white, you can see why the white percentage is expected to continue to decline going forward. Even if all the birth rates were the same, which they're not, the white birth rate is lower, this is obviously the most dramatic feature of why the white population as a share of the country will decline. The other thing worth noting is how immigrants get here. Almost half, 48%, are related to a U.S. citizen, 20% are family-sponsored, 13% refugees or asylum seekers, 12% from employment, 4% due to a lottery. In Canada and Australia, well over half of the new immigrants come as a result of skills-based judgments or specific employment. In the last year, the single country with the largest number of immigrants was Mexico with 171,000, then China at 72,000, Cuba, India, the Dominican Republic, Philippines, Vietnam. Those are the top seven, all of them 40,000 or more in a given year. So that clearly is having an impact. And again, the fastest growing population segment in America right now are Asians. And Asians, that's a pretty large continent. That's half the world's population. But it's coming from a lot of different countries, from Pakistan and India. There was a rally the president had in Houston. 50,000 Indians in the Houston area showed up. There are 4.4 million Indian Americans in the United States right now. That number is, for instance, about at least one and a half times the size of the Muslim population in America. Now, some of the 4.4 million are Muslim, but most of them are Hindu. So you're seeing that in terms of where we get people from, most people really don't know. And they have assumptions that most legal immigration comes from Mexico, when that number is maybe 15-16% of the total at this point. Then you have migration between the states. This should be no great surprise, but people tend to move from states with high taxes that are bankrupt to states and that are cold to states that are warmer with low taxes. The net migration each year in the United States has been declining. About 4% of families move every year from one state to another. And not surprisingly, the states with the largest in-migration are Florida, South Carolina, Texas, Tennessee, Nevada, Arizona. The state of Washington, which is an exception because it's north, but it's one of the most booming states as far as economics. Also, smaller states, Utah, Idaho, Montana, South Dakota, North Carolina, and Oregon. Those are states that are the net winners in the in-migration. The out-migration, the losing states, no great shock there either. Illinois, New Jersey, New York, California, Connecticut, Maryland, North Dakota, Alaska, West Virginia, and Pennsylvania. If you want to get a cheap bid from a moving company, tell them you're moving from Texas to Chicago. It's first time they'd have a full truck going in that direction. Among subgroups, there are differences. African Americans have been leaving northern cities and moving, and most significantly, to Georgia, but also to North Carolina, South Carolina, Texas, and Florida. One of the reasons those states are less Republican than they used to be is because they're getting an influx of African Americans who at a minimum vote 85% for the Democrats and often 90%. Georgia has two U.S. Senate races in 2020, and Republicans need to be pretty aware that the demographics of Georgia have changed. It's only a 60% white state. Californians tend to move relatively close by, Colorado, Utah, Nevada, Washington, Texas. You don't find a lot of Californians moving to Florida. The states, some states, because of the change in the state and local tax situation, are also driving people out at particularly rapid rate, and those include New Jersey, New York, Connecticut, and Illinois. Any Illinois people tend to go any place that'll take them, Florida, Texas, Arizona. And there's a money shift because these people are carrying, in a lot of cases, their above average income and they're trying to avoid the cutoff in taxes. So is there an emerging Democratic majority? I realize I've gone on here. I'm looking at the time. I'll try to wrap this up in a couple minutes. There's no question that younger generations are increasingly liberal. It's always been the case that as you go through age changes, Republicans do better as people get older. The assumption was people are always liberal as kids and they get more conservative as they get older. But now the difference between older and younger voters is as large as it's ever been. Among those 18 to 29, Democrats win about two-thirds of the vote. Among those 30 to 44, they win about 60% of the vote. Some of that, I think, is attributable to changes in the educational system, in particular, the environment in the public schools, including high schools. It has an impact before you get to college, and obviously it's reinforced in college. There's a lot more people who consider themselves woke racially now. Climate change is a big issue that seems to get mainstream starting with five-year-olds. And there's an increasing tolerance for intolerance towards those who are non-woke. And again, I think big role for the teachers' unions and colleges in all this, training a lot of social justice warriors. And one of the reasons that there's been this reaction, one of the reasons I think Trump did well, particularly among non-college educated whites in 2016, was a reaction to this perception of essentially a politically correct nation, abortion absolutism, boycotts of restaurants that they go to like Chick-fil-A, being called deplorables, trade deals that favor elites and damage their towns and eliminate their factories. So this has been a change that's been ongoing since the Reagan Democrats from the 80s, but really picked up dramatically in 2016. Almost 40% of the counties that Barack Obama won switched to Trump in 2016 from 2012. Whites with college degrees used to be a Republican voting group, though not by nearly as high a percentage as non-college educated, but that too has been changing. And in the last election in 2018, whites actually voted Democratic majority, which is a big shift. And if it's not reversed by 2020 in the presidential election, it doesn't augur well for Republican chances at the White House or lower down the ticket. Finally, Lynn, talk a little bit about the Electoral College and how that's influenced by these demographic changes. Obviously, where immigrants move, where migrants between the states move has an impact. The states that changed between 2012 and 2016 were six: Michigan, Wisconsin, Pennsylvania, Ohio, Iowa, and Florida. Those six states with 100 electoral votes shifted from the Democrats to the Republicans. Barack Obama had won 332 electoral college votes. Hillary Clinton won 232. What about those six states make them a little bit different than the norm? Well, Iowa's 94% white voters, Wisconsin 90%, Michigan 82%, Pennsylvania 84%. And well over half of the white voters in each of those states are non-college educated. This was a fertile ground for the Trump campaign. They recognized it early on, spent a lot of resources there, a lot of time at rallies. People who come to rallies vote. You can't say that about someone who necessarily does anything else in a campaign, but if they show up at a rally, it's a pretty good chance they're going to vote. And if you look at the margins in some of those states, 11,000 in Michigan, 22,000 in Wisconsin, that's probably just the voters at a couple of rallies in the last couple of weeks of the campaign. And the exit polls were wrong because they underestimated the share of white voters who were non-college educated. Obviously, since they voted overwhelmingly for Trump, whereas college voters voted narrowly for Trump in 2016, that made a difference. So what do I think going forward? I think the demographic changes do favor the Democrats, but candidates matter. What each party offers as far as messaging matters. What do the parties stand for at this point? What is their, is it a negative message or is it a positive message? If it's a positive message, how do they reach out and effectively target particular voter segments put together a majority, which is shifting from cycle to cycle based on the changes in the demographics. So I'd say Texera and Judas were probably right. It'll take longer than they expected. There'll be bumps along the road. But unless Republicans can significantly increase their share of the vote among minorities or win back the votes they've lost among college-educated whites, it does look like Democrats will be the stronger party going forward, at least for the next couple of decades. And I'll stop there.
Thank you, Richard. As a reminder, people, send your questions to info@jewishpolicycenter.org or to our Twitter account at the JPC. We have some questions to start, and Richard, following right off your last sentence, conservatives and or Republicans often say that Hispanics and African Americans, whose communities emphasize family values and entrepreneurialism and church and education, are what the questioner calls natural Republican voters, especially in growing economies. But a GOP breakthrough rarely happens in those communities. Why is that?
I think the Republican hopes are a little too high among Hispanics because Hispanics do not dislike government. In fact, if you look at polling among Hispanics and among African Americans, both groups are more comfortable with a larger role for government than white voters are. It's one of the major reasons why they vote more Democratic than white voters do. As far as the attachment to conservatives' social policies and also entrepreneurial activity, there are differences, again, among individual Hispanic communities. The Cubans come from a background of hostility to Marxism, you know, which seized their property and their land, drove them away. I suspect Venezuelans in Florida will be a Republican voting group this year. In Texas, there are a higher percentage of small business people who are Hispanic than there are in California, which is one of the reasons why Hispanics do a little bit better there. But in general, I don't see that the Hispanics are going to could ever become a majority Hispanic community, Republican group, but they could do better than 30%. There were a year in 2004, George W. Bush won almost 45% of the Hispanic vote in Texas. He didn't need that high a percentage to win Texas, but now Republicans may need more Hispanic voters in Texas because white voters are shifting away from them.
Okay, thank you. On the issue of African-American demographic trends, two questions. First of all, there has been an increase in intermarriage between both Hispanic-Americans and white Americans, also African-Americans and white Americans. Do the offspring of mixed marriages vote in a particular way? What if there's an intermarriage between a Republican and a Democrat? Has anybody been tracking, actually, is the question.
It is an interesting question. And there are not, I've actually looked it up, but I haven't seen any formal surveys on that. Though the speculation is that mixed marriages between whites and blacks, by the way, which are much more common with black men and white women than white men and black women, that those marriages tend to be among people who are traditionally liberal and tolerant to begin with. It's easier to do now probably than it was 10, 15, 20 years ago. So there may be differences based on the length of the marriage and how old the individuals are. But among Hispanics and among Asian Americans in particular, there's very high intermarriage rates. Japanese intermarry at a rate as high or higher than Jewish Americans do. So those changes probably reinforce, in my view, voting patterns that are already in effect, and because I think they're more likely to be more similar than different. Given the kind of political environment in this country, it's probably easier to have a mixed marriage of a lot of differences other than political.
Okay. Is the same true, another question, the percentage of voters telling exit pollsters that they have no religious affiliation continues to rise, reaching nearly 20% in the 2016 presidential election. Does religious affiliation and or religious intermarriage have an impact on voting trends?
Absolutely. The Republican vote share rises with the frequency with which people are in a church or a synagogue or even mosque. And there's no question, if you look at the numbers and the lack of affiliation, particularly among those age 18 to 29 and those age 30 to 44, that the groups that show the highest vote share for Democrats are the groups that are the least affiliated. So it does appear that kind of the Leave It to Beaver family environment, the Cleavers, intact families, go to church on Sunday. That's kind of lifestyle is a shrinking one in the United States at the moment. More people live together who aren't married. More people are single and never have children, never get married, never have children. All of these things lead, I think, to a lower affiliation rate. Not absolutely. There are plenty of single people who are affiliated and active. But the trend line is not a good one for Republicans who do better with social cohesion.
Thank you. One thing that you haven't mentioned is the possibility of electoral fraud. There are places in California that have more registered voters than they have individuals living in the district. How big an issue is fraud, and does fraud tend to go one particular way or another?
It's kind of funny. The only incident in 2018 of fraud that caused an election to be redone was in a congressional district in North Carolina where the Republican won, and he was accused of doing a ballot harvesting, which has now become common and legal in California, and probably resulted in the defeat of three or four Republican congressmen. These are people walking into nursing homes or other institutions and just collecting ballots, and for all we know, completing them, because no one's comparing signatures on the ballot that's turned in with someone's voter registration card. So there's certainly the possibility of it, and I think it's more likely because I think the Democrats are better organized in cities where there's larger concentrations of population, and it's easier as a result to get significant numbers of votes in a day or in a week. Especially with all the early voting that goes on now and the absentee voting. There are a couple states where virtually everyone votes now other than on election day. So I think it is an issue. I can't give you a number for how large it is. But if you talk to a bunch of Democrats, they would probably tell you that the 2000 election was stolen in Florida. They've never forgotten it. And they have completely different orientation to who's responsible for vote theft, if it occurs.
Okay. We have a question that's slightly off the main topic, but not unrelated to the main topic. How do we make immigrants into good citizens? Was the melting pot, which produced E Pluribus Unum, in which immigrants were expected to give up some of their former culture, is that a better model than what I think we call a chopped salad today, where every immigrant group is expected to remain loyal and attached to its former culture?
Well, the question is, who has that expectation that they're going to remain attached? Is it the immigrant or are political actors within those communities? And again, since the immigrant communities tend to vote Democratic, the people who are pushing essentially greater group identification as opposed to being a citizen of a nation, the melting pot, I think it has a political motivation. But I don't necessarily think that a large percentage of those who are becoming new immigrants or are becoming citizens of the United States. They're immigrants. They go through their permanent residence period. They become citizens. My wife went through one of these. I've been in a bunch of these ceremonies. There's an extraordinary amount of pride that people have when they become citizens. And they understand that this is a different country. And, yeah, people are trying to, through intersectional theory, put everyone in a box and show that they're shared interests among these particular minority groups. And the best way to represent your group is to join with that group in opposing this policy or supporting that policy. But that doesn't mean that everyone wants to think politics 24 hours a day. There's an exhaustion factor in this country. I mean, there was when Clinton was president, there were people who hated them. There were people who hated Bush. The people hated Obama. And now maybe there's a record number who hate Trump. It used to be, somebody won the election. You suck it up. They won. You lost. Fight harder the next time. And I think a lot of people who come to this country and they're immigrants and they have a family here and their future is here. They don't think just about the next election. I mean, they try to live their lives. So I think that you make an argument that immigrants may be among those who are better at resisting some of those group pressures than others at this country who, have to adopt a certain political ideology because they feel guilty because they grew up with privilege.
For our last question, we'll go back to something more specific. Jewish voters have been traditionally Democrats in large numbers. Is that changing at all?
I think it is changing, though you may not see it in 2020. But within the Jewish community, the sizes of individual groups are changing. The Orthodox have well above a replacement population growth rate, whereas more secular Jews have among the lowest growth rates in the country in terms of the number of children per family, number of children per woman of childbearing age on an annual basis. So the share of all those who identify as Jewish who are Orthodox is growing as a share of the population. It's probably between 10 and 15% now, but among those under age 18, it may be as large as a quarter or more. You can see this in the pressure on Jewish day schools to find spots. Now, the Jewish community is by and large a community that has always been more liberal than pretty much every other white voting group. And that's still the case today. In 2016, Jews voted a little over 70% for Clinton, which is a lot less than was the share that voted for her husband when he ran. He got almost 90% against the first Bush in 1992 and almost as high a number against Bob Dole. So Republicans have done somewhat better. The only time they actually were competitive was when Jimmy Carter ran, and people, even liberal Jews, sort of understood that Carter had it in for Israel, and that made a difference. The Democrat vote share was only 45%. The third-party candidate got 20% of the Jewish vote, John Anderson, and Reagan got about 40%. So I think the Jewish sort of plateau among the vote share for Republicans is probably in the 30 to 40% range, and a candidate who is less unusual than Trump, who has obviously been very pro-Israel in many ways, but doesn't get any credit for it and is viewed as having been responsible for anti-Semitic shootings by a significant percentage of the Jewish community. I don't think he's going to see any big numbers shifting from 2020, despite the fact it'd be hard to imagine a more pro-Israel president over the last 3 years than he's been.
Well, that's about as close to a political answer as we're going to get today. I want to thank you, Richard, for your time and some really interesting insights. I have to tell you, I have to think about what they mean now as I proceed, but it's a different way of looking at our country and the people who live in it, and we appreciate it. To the members of the Jewish Policy Center who came on the call today, thank you for joining us, and we look forward to having you again in the future.